Elliot Friedman, you're back, you're tanned, you're healthy, you're relaxed, you're ready to get back to work. Now, what happened in Florida?
You're talking about when I was there for Disney World or for the GM meetings?
More so the GM meetings, but if you want a little splash about how you took the family there and had a detour back to Calgary and then come out all the way back here.
Oh, man, that almost got me a divorce. But okay. No, let's
move
fast.
Okay, ring is still on. We're still good.
We're good. The GM meetings were interesting. Like, I have to admit, it's very hard to get caught by surprise at those meetings. I was caught by surprise at these ones because I didn't think there was any way we'd get a situation where the referees would give up control on the ice. And they did. And, you know, the referees and the players, they deserve credit for making it happen. But the GMs, they pushed for this. They really fought for it, and they're going
to
get it.
The sense that I get from the officials that I speak to is they're fed up getting criticized for it. They're done.
Well, maybe.
Like, every single call is wrong. They're sick of waking up every morning and reading that they're idiots.
I believe that. And, you know, actually, I'm writing that in my notes this week. And I think the other thing, too, was I think the people in the Situation Room told them, you know, you're not the guys getting the phone calls. We get the phone calls.
Yep.
Colin Campbell was actually the guy, I think, who made it so that it was a $25,000 fine if you went to the referee's room during a game or after. So he says, you know, you guys think you get complained at a lot. You don't even take the phone calls.
Yeah.
I'm curious to see where we're going to go with this, but I was surprised that everybody so quickly did this. And the thing that was really interesting to me, Jeff, was so they said on the Monday we might have something by Wednesday, and on the Tuesday they came out and said we've gone to ask about it, the players and the officials. And it caught the officials by surprise, I learned later, because all of a sudden we're tweeting out, okay, they've gone for it. And all of a sudden the referees were saying, wait a sec, there was supposed to be no news today, and now there's news. Like, what's going on?
Well,
so I think the whole process caught people by surprise.
Interesting point to that. You and I spoke on Hockey Central Tonight on Monday.
Yeah.
And you seemed to be of the opinion at that time that nothing was going to be settled.
We didn't know what the solution was. Like, they kept it to themselves about what they were doing.
You put forward, okay, this is an option. Everything gets centralized in the Situation Room, and it's a collection of a small handful of people, maybe one ex-official, maybe two, that end up making the decision, but there's nothing concrete on it.
Obviously, this is why I hate the term insider, because we didn't have the full picture. We weren't inside enough. And it's funny because somebody told me it's going to be the Situation Room making the call. Somebody told me it's going to be retired officials in the Situation Room, and it turned out that both were correct. Mm-hmm. But you hear it and you're thinking, okay, it's either this or this, and I didn't realize that it could be both. So, yeah, I have to admit I was surprised. You know, once on Tuesday, the first they said, okay, we're talking to the players and we're talking to the referees, and then by about 6 o'clock that night, I kind of had a feeling that it was going to get done, that the players were involved enough that they wanted to change it and the referees were willing to change it. But it was kind of weird. Like, it went from we weren't expecting a change to we're going to have a change pretty quick.
And this is the NHL reacting to the very public pressure every time there is a video review.
Yes and no. Like,
normally they dig in their heels on these things, and it takes a while for this to strip away.
Well, I think what happens is, Jeff, you got to pick your battles, what you want to win and what you're going to lose. Like, the one the NHL dug the heels on was I thought there was going to be a change to the offside review.
But the GMs didn't go for it.
Well, and I'll tell you that I had a GM who said that he thought it was going to happen last year, and Bettman dug his heels down and said, we're not changing it. And that same GM told me, yeah, I think we've got the votes again this year. And they actually took a vote, and it was like 21 to 10 against.
Yep.
And I heard one of the things they said was, and the commissioner I heard said this was, or he told them, if we do it lifted by a skate lifted off the ice, okay, here's this angle. Can you tell me for sure it's lifted off the ice? So we're going to go from one problem to another. And the guys bought that.
So you have to have an ice level camera, like at the ice, to see if the skate was off.
Yes.
Because you don't have the proper view.
And even sometimes that angle is tricky. So they bought it. I think they decided if they were going to make a change, that was the one they were willing to make, which was the goaltender interference and not the offside. And to be fair, there are some GMs who say, like, how long have these guys been playing hockey? They know what the rule is.
Mm-hmm. You know, Jeff Jurdat's one of our producers here at Sportsnet, an excellent producer who brought up a great point on Twitter yesterday or the day before.
Mm-hmm.
He said if they're going to this centralized decision for goalie interference, then there is no reason for us to pause the game even more for a referee to go to the bench to explain the call to a coach. because it's not his call.
Well, they're
call.
Not supposed to.
It's not his. It happens all the time.
Yeah, but
coach will call him. Now forever, the official can say, what are you calling me over? I didn't make the call.
Well, you know what? You're right. And they're not really supposed to go do that anymore, although it does happen. It
happens all the time.
I thought you were going to say that now you can have a penalty, and I'm really against that idea.
A penalty?
For a missed goaltender interference challenge. Now, Bettman did kind of hint that that might be something down the road. I really disagree with that. Man, you know, offside is more black and white. That's a total judgment call.
I've always maintained the goalie interference is still where figure skating hits the NHL. It's still a judgment.
Absolutely. I think if there was a penalty for that, it would be so wrong. So wrong.
Now, have they dug themselves into a hole that they can't dig themselves out of here? Like, this is a self-inflicted one. Anytime you pause the game to focus attention on something for 5 minutes, there's going to be problems, specifically when you're dealing with a flow game. I don't think this is going to solve much. I think there's still going to be the issues. There's still going to be the problems.
Well,
because you're stopping a flow game to look at something pixel by pixel.
Yeah, yeah. But the way I look at it is that they've limited the number of people who can make a decision now, right? It's basically down to some combination of two or three people. Colin Campbell, Mike Murphy, Kay Whitmore, Chris King, Rod Pasma. And it's probably less than that group.
Was there any discussion of them creating a video not unlike what the Department of Player Safety do to
yes,
explain
they have
the
talked
call.
About that.
See, that to me would sort of calm everybody down.
Probably. But
like,
the
I think
thing
that's
is,
at the root of the problem.
Yes,
nobody like,
nobody
okay.
knows.
See, for
and
me,
they have started sending out that thing to yes. the GMs. But it's kind of funny. But like now at least there's probably a maximum of five people who could make the call. And I bet you it's even less than those five. I bet you it's some three of those five or
yeah.
two of those five.
Curious what your standard is, because to me, I've always looked at it this way. If you go into the crease by yourself, mm-hmm. on your own, not pushed, your liability, the liability standard goes through the roof. And I don't care if you just nudge the goaltender. You've decided to go into the crease.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't outside the crease. Otherwise, I think we mentioned this on the podcast a few weeks ago, don't bother to paint the crease blue anymore because it doesn't mean anything. Just make it the rest of the ice. Just don't make it the crease. If you go in deliberately, liability through the roof.
I agree with that. I think the other thing is, are you trying to score? Like, I thought the Dumoulin one was ridiculous. He's trying to score.
But there was already a penalty called on him, so the minute he touched the puck, that was a penalty.
Yeah, but again, like, I looked at him like he's trying to score a goal.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the one before the All-Star game where Strome scored when McDavid went through the crease, I thought that was ridiculous. He's trying to score a goal.
By my standard, that's not a goal. But again, yeah. my definition isn't your definition,
stupid.
Isn't Emil's definition, isn't anyone who's listening to this podcast
definition. But now the thing is, like, now it's going to be down to two or three people. And I guess the key thing is, Jeff, if it was me and you and we disagree, then yeah. the whole system's screwed up. But if it's me and you and one guy makes a call, so we have to live with the standard of that call,
yeah.
then you probably have a chance.
Great point. Who has the hammer on that night? If there's three guys making the decision, obviously it's two versus one.
It's
but
gonna,
if there's two.
Well,
who's got the hammer?
We're going to find out, right? I like this better.
Don't get me wrong. I'm the same. I like it better. It's getting better.
You know what I love, though, about the GM meetings is, okay, I love the commissioner whenever he talks to the GM meetings.
The standard hasn't changed in terms of what goaltender interference is. Obviously, it's a judgment call. And as some of you know from the session we did here on Monday, even you didn't have full agreement on the video, and there are just some close calls where it comes down to judgment. Yes, it's only been a handful of calls, but I guess if I'm a coach and I issue the challenge and I'm wrong, I'm going to be unhappy about that, even if the challenge maybe shouldn't have been made in the first instance. Coach's challenge probably shouldn't have been used 170 times. Okay, there are lots of times where a coach issues it when we're really using it to correct a glaring error, not an argument over whether it could have been or might not have been. So I get it, but I think some of the attention it got was way disproportionate to the way this is working, because again, half a dozen or so calls out of 170 reviews. If you ask Coley and you ask the officials, overwhelmingly there's been agreement between the officials on the ice and the people in Toronto. Overwhelmingly.
Okay, one of my favorite movies of all time is A Clockwork Orange. If you haven't seen it, go see it. If you're not yet 18, ask your parents.
It is violent, though, folks.
It's violent. It's a rough one. There's a lot of other stuff in there.
Oh, yeah.
But it's like when Roddy McDowell, who's one of the greatest actors ever,
yes,
goes in to get brainwashed, and he comes out, at least for a short time, a different
listening
guy.
Listening to lovely Ludwig von.
Yes.
Yes.
At least he comes out for a short time, a different guy. The best thing is, like, you've got all these coaches killing goaltender interference. Even while the meetings are going on, Phil Housley and Claude Julien are killing goaltender interference. But the GM's there like, it's not that bad, okay? And it's like the clockwork orange goes on. You know, the commissioner, he hammers them. He says, guys, you cannot hurt the league like this. You cannot bash the league. So for a few weeks or a few days or at least right around there, the message always come out from the people who are there. Everything's okay. We just have a few things we have to tweak.
Now, is that
is one of my favorite parts of the GM meeting.
Is that when the NHL shows the general managers of number of offenses we're actually dealing with here?
It is that. Like,
we're not dealing with hundreds of calls.
They took us in and they showed us, and I really like the fact they did it. But the bottom line is it's more like, hey, stop it. You know, enough people bash the league. We don't need you guys to give them license to do it too. And they all toe the line for at least a short period.
How much discussion was there about goaltender embellishment? By my count, I've only seen it twice this year. I'm probably off on it, but I've only seen two goalie embellishment calls this year.
Colin Campbell told us he thinks the goalie coaches teach it.
Well, there's a few high-profile guys, and one of them's the highest-profile guy who has taken it to an art and doesn't care if the puck goes by him. He puts himself, and that's funny, I've had a goalie coach show me how it happens, how he puts himself in position to do this, just to get that call. And because he's a superstar, and hey, it's Saturday night on Hockey Night in Canada, and the goalie's down, the puck just went in, and he got bumped, what do you think is going to happen?
Who are we talking about?
It's an elite-level netminder from the West.
All right.
He doesn't play in the West, however. He's from Western Canada, but he doesn't play in the West. Anyhow, I firmly believe that goalie coaches teach that.
Is it Glenn Hall?
Yeah, he got bumped by a Noel Picard in the Bobby Orr goal in 1970. So there was concert for that?
Yeah, there was conversation about that. And there have been goalies this year who have been fined for it.
Yeah, I've only seen two. We shall see. On that, let's start the podcast. Welcome to 31 Thoughts, the podcast brought to you by the all-new 2018 GMC Terrain. Love my 31 Thoughts. What a great weekly staple from two guys that I pretty well knew as day oneers in the business. Elliot Friedman was actually an intern day one on the Gordon Damian show. We were filling in on the mornings back in the Fan 590. Back then, I don't think he had 31 thoughts in a week, so it's great to hear him pound these out in a few minutes' time. I always thought Elliot would be huge, but I thought it'd be basketball. He was the biggest NBA fan going. And the other part about Elliot, much better broadcaster than third base coach like he was for the Score baseball team. We set a record for guys thrown out at home as Elliot told him to go for it, go for it. On the other side, Jeff Merrick was also a day oneer and enjoyed him. He was on like Friday night. He's used to the podcast thing because he used to do a Friday night show that went on for as long as they wanted to.
True.
And I'm just glad he's back doing it because 31 thoughts, he couldn't get one thought in on the iDesk. Here they are, Elliot Friedman and Jeff Merrick. I love me a good iDesk reference. That was Gord Stellick from Sportsnet, also a host of Sirius Satellite Radio NHL Network morning show alongside Rob Simpson. Thank you for that, Gord Stellick.
You know, it's so funny that I do remember working with Gordon Damian on the morning show that week. That was the week in 1994 where after Mike Keenan won the Stanley Cup with the New York Rangers, he bolted and quit and went to the St. Louis Blues.
And then there was a tampering charge, I believe.
Well, what I remember is they were on the morning show, and Keenan went on WFAN in New York to do an interview, and I was an intern, and WFAN sent us a copy of the interview, and I had to cut up the clips and say, get them on the air.
Yeah.
And Damian and Gord brought me the tape, and they said, you're working with us? And I go, yes. And I go, we want these clips. How soon can you get them for us? And I think they expected me to say, like, it would take an hour.
Yeah, yeah.
And I go, I can get them to you in, like, 15 minutes. Cause,
how did you, back, that was, like, reel-to-reel and
no, that wasn't
tape
real.
And
that
razor
wasn't
blades.
Reel-to-reel. That was, that one was on a cassette
tape. That was
carts? Tape. It was a cassette tape.
Okay.
And that's one of the first things I learned was how to do that. So I said, no, 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 I can get it to you in 15 minutes. And at the end of the show, like, they played those clips. At the end of the show,
yeah.
They actually said, thank you very much to our intern, Elliot Freeman, for his hustle in the newsroom. That was the first time I ever got praised on air
really?
For anything.
You know what? I can't remember. I think I've ever told you this before.
Nice.
Do you know who taught me how to use the internet?
Who was that?
You.
Really?
This was 1994. Four at the Fan.
We had one internet computer.
One.
Yes.
You remember this story.
And I don't remember teaching you, but I remember that computer.
That's right. And I kept hearing, okay, you got to get on. Because Strombo was all over it, obviously,
yes,
right?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I remember I talked to someone. It might have been Nancy Matheson. And she's like, I don't know, but talk to Elliot. Mm-hmm. And you were there. I'm like, dude, can you give me 5 minutes on what this internet thing is and how do I? Because I think you were the only guy on the floor that knew how to use it. I don't think anybody else did.
There probably would have been a couple, but.
I don't know.
I do remember that one computer and showing people how to use that computer.
Yep.
But, you know, like...
it would crush us when the door was locked. We'd come in and
fight.
Like,
oh,
can't get the internet door open.
I do remember training under those guys. And actually, the morning show back then, I think, was Bob. And he was on McCown. He was on vacation. And those guys stepped in.
Right.
That morning show was the first paid shift after volunteering at the Fan. And it was... news backup. You were on from 3 a.m. to 8 a.m. and I paid you $80.
Who was sports director then?
Scott Metcalf.
Legend.
Yeah, it started
wonderful
my career.
Man.
Absolutely.
Wonderful
fantastic
man.
Guy.
Wow.
I did that whole story without saying back when I covered the NBA. So those of you who tweet at me with this being a drinking game,
nah.
That doesn't count.
Whatever Elliot references, he used to cover the NBA.
Yeah.
I'll drink.
That doesn't count though.
All right, to 31 Thoughts. Who's Steve Greeley?
Steve Greeley is now one of the assistant general managers of the Buffalo Sabres. Him and Randy Sexton are the assistants to Jason Botterill. And Steve Greeley is one of the guys who got an interview with the Carolina Hurricanes in their current GM search. He's 37 years old. He played at Boston University from 2000 to 2003. One of his teammates was Ryan Whitney, and Ryan Whitney was in his wedding party, I found out. You know, I was like, okay, I mean, I know who – Mike Fiuta is, who got a conversation. I know who Paul Fenton is, who got a conversation. I know who Lawrence Gilman is, who got a conversation. And, you know, Steve Greeley, I really didn't know. And Steve Greeley played a year in the East Coast Hockey League after he was done. And he's a littler guy. And, you know, someone said to me, he was really smart, pretty skilled guy. But at that time, small guys didn't get a chance. And now he'd have a better chance to make it as a player. So he
5'7", 160.
Yeah, so he finished up his ECHL year, and he went into the financial sector. And in 2006, he sent a letter. I heard it was all the GMs and AGMs, and he told me no, it was only about half. And two replied. He wanted to work in the NHL. And one was Michael Connell, who was new in L.A., mm-hmm. and the other he said he couldn't remember. But he knew Michael Connell because they was from the Boston Hockey Mafia, and he caddied for Michael Connell at O'Connell's golf course. So it was on a Saturday. Michael Connell invited him to his house and said, you know, let's come meet and we'll chat. On the Monday, Dean Lombardi, newly hired in L.A., flew him out there for an interview. And on the Wednesday, he was working. And he got a job as a scout. And, you know, he also took a job in a warehouse at that time to help get his benefits and bring up his salary. And, you know, he's a pretty upwardly mobile guy. He went from a scout in L.A. to the associate head coach of Boston University Hockey to assistant director of, I think, player personnel with the Rangers, now to the Sabres. And, you know, people who told me about him said that, you know, he has a good judge of talent. He believes in numbers. And I'm writing advanced information in my blog because of you.
Thank you.
And, you know, also the eye test. But the big concern people had about him is they said he's really ambitious. And one guy said sometimes he's like a runaway train with his ambition. And you know what, Jeff? I reached out to him. I said, I'd like to talk to you. And he said, sure. And we spoke. And, you know, when you ask a guy that kind of a question the first time you speak to him, you're like, okay, where's this going to go? Is this guy going to be like, you're a dick? Or is this guy going to say, you know what, that's fair. And, mm-hmm. and he came at me with B. He said, you know what, like, it's not the first time I've been told that. But, like, you know, this is the way I feel. I feel like every time I've left for an opportunity, it's been a better opportunity. It's allowed me to learn more under great people. And, he, you know, he said, like, right now, I only care about the Buffalo Sabres. I want us to find players. I want us to get better. But when this comes up, you know, you can't say no. And the funny thing about it was he was on a two-day scouting trip in Minnesota when Tom Dundon called and said, come down to Cabo and let's meet. Like, I'm like, how many clothes did you have in Minnesota that look good for Cabo? And he laughed. It sounds like, you know, Steve Greeley is a guy who's on the track, and I think he relished the opportunity at least to talk to the Hurricanes about
it. It's a non-traditional way to get there. You know, I was texting with a current assistant general manager in the NHL yesterday, and he sent me this, and I'll read it to you. It's a picture of a guy staring at his phone, and there's a caption beside it. It says, obviously, a guy on a conference call. The quickest tell that you're in trouble is saying, quote, this is how we've always done it.
Yeah. You know, when Scott Moore, who's our boss now, got hired at the CBC, I can't remember what year that was. That's got to be about 2011, 2012. His first meeting with the general staff is, I don't ever want to hear this is the way we've always done it. Yeah. It's funny. Like, I know someone, you know, from my era of school who is much more successful financially than I am. He's done very well. And we don't really keep in touch a lot, but, you know, we speak to each other from time to time. He doesn't like that I'm a reporter. He says, not that I don't trust you, but I don't want to, I don't like reporters. You know, like, I think he's dabbled in some NHL teams before. Like, I think he's had chances to buy teams.
Right.
And I suspect that one of the reasons he stayed out of hockey is that he thinks that his way wouldn't work in hockey.
Wouldn't work or wouldn't be accepted, so he wouldn't have the chance?
Well, probably some combination of both. And the more I've learned about the way Tom Dundon approaches Carolina, like, I think one of the reasons him and Ron Francis didn't get along was that if he had a question about coaching or a strategy that was used, he would call Bill Peters directly. And, you know, any GM's going to hate that.
Yeah.
But he says, no, 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 that's the way I run my business. And one of our conversations, I said that one of the questions about you is, will you give people authority? And he says, I disagree with that. And I said, well, that's what people who have interviewed are saying. And he said, that's fine, but I disagree with that. Because I think he looks at it as, we create a model, and the model is how we do things, but you are free to make your decisions in that model.
Yep.
And most GMs are like, no, 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 I create the way we do it, and everybody
and
else
execute.
Works from there.
Yeah.
So I think it's semantics, but it's a pretty big difference in semantics.
There's a feeling out there amongst people that I talk to. You've had, I'm sure, the exact same conversations.
Mm-hmm.
And this is from the old school hockey guys. Who would want that job? All you're doing is taking orders.
You're right. You're 1,000% right. And this guy, you know, he reached out to me last week and he said, I see you've talked to Tom Dundon. I said, yes. And he goes, what do you think? And we were talking about it. And he goes, at some point in time, this is coming. He said, there aren't a lot of Jeff Vinnicks out there anymore who say,
that's
Steve Yzerman.
Yep, hands all yours.
You do it your way. He says, this is the way the world works now. And he said, sooner or later, hockey is going to get dragged in kicking and screaming. And the question is, when is that going to happen? I'll tell you this. I don't think that Tom Dundon needs a quote-unquote hockey guy. I think what Tom Dundon needs is somebody who's got a long fuse, a thick skin, can manage up, and say to all his hockey people there, guys, I'm going to be your shield. You better do a great job underneath me. I'm going to keep this guy off you, but I need you to be great. And that's what he needs there. But, I mean, the other big question, Jeff, is how much money is he going to pour into scouting and things like that? That's a big question. But I don't think they necessarily need a hockey person there as GM. I think they need a hockey person who's more able to say, I'm going to manage up and keep this guy and handle this guy you guys have to be great around me.
Doesn't this already happen, though, around the NHL?
More and more.
It's interesting to
ask Jim Nill.
Even when we heard, we've had, you know, Doug McLean on this podcast, and anyone that's, you know, watched us on Sportsnet knows we work with Doug, and he's talked countless times about having to manage Mr. McConnell when he worked with the Columbus Blue Jackets, and that was just part of the job.
Why is this different? I think in some places it's different than others. Like, I don't think Toronto has that problem. I think their ownership has realized we're going to stay in the background and let you guys do what you need to do. I don't think Steve Yzerman has that problem. I don't think Edmonton had that problem until they had this particular year, right? You know, I think some teams, the ownership meddles or is involved, and I think some teams, they don't.
That's a semantic dance right there, by the way. Some say involved and some say meddle.
Yeah,
if you're cynical, you say, oh, the owner's meddling, as opposed to, oh, the owner's involved in the decision because he owns this thing.
Yes. But I think, look, like Steve Yzerman probably has the best setup. I think Toronto used to be one of the worst setups. I think it's now one of the really better ones. I think Jeff Molson is a guy who really wants to let his general manager do the job. Now, when things go sideways, everybody's involved. But I think in this particular situation, you're going to need a guy who's got big ones to say, guys, I'm going to manage up, but I need you to be great around me.
There's going to be a lot of people cheering for this team because of this model that you're talking about.
A lot of people who are new.
Younger hockey fans, observers.
We've talked about it. It's like Florida.
This is Florida, but I get the sense that this guy's not going to panic. Florida, there was panic.
Yes.
When the losses piled up and a couple of decisions went a little bit sideways, there was a screen to go back to where it was before just to calm everybody down.
Mm-hmm.
And look, Florida Panthers may make the playoffs this year. We're going to talk to Jason York here in a second on the 31 Thoughts podcast. The all-new 2018 GMC Terrain is the compact SUV thoughtfully designed with you in mind. With features like the Traction Select system to revolutionize how you adapt to the road, a fold flat front passenger seat to give you up to 8 feet of cargo space, and an innovative electronic precision shift system to make shifting easier than ever, the 2018 GMC Terrain is truly mighty like a pro. GMC, we are professional grade. Jason York, how much do you love me? Scale of 1 to 10.
How much do I love Jeff Merrick?
Yeah.
8.5.
8.5, eh? Yeah, that's going to go down a whole bunch here in a second.
Oh!
Here's why. So yesterday on Hockey Central at noon, I was working with Mark Savard and Doug McLean. You played with Savard with the Boston Bruins.
Yes, I did.
And Doug was with you with Detroit / Adirondack.
Yep.
So I said, do you guys have any Jason York stories you can share for the podcast? They said, absolutely. So after the radio show went off the air yesterday, we came downstairs and Emil put all this together. And we'll start with Doug. And here's the deal. Doug, tell us a good Jason York story.
Yeah, Jason York. I almost forgot I had him as a player, to be quite honest. You know, he was sort of an afterthought. But anyway, I'm kidding. If I'm not mistaken, I think I signed his first couple of NHL contracts. You know, it's always juicy to talk about catching a guy out after curfew, which I did catch him at least one or two occasions, but I'm not going to go into that because that's not fair. But on his contract, I remember he and his agent, Pat Morris, they thought they had me on his deal, and I stuck to my guns and forced him to take a bad two-way deal. And I remember Jason pouted about it for at least 2 years. But anyway, all kidding aside, Jason went on to have a great career. And now I really realized how he made it because of his smarts on the ice, to be quite honest. He was a real smart player. And now when he's a broadcaster, he knows everything. It's just like the rest of us.
And now he's a broadcaster, he knows everything. What's the story about?
Wait a second.
What?
Talk about the pot calling the kettle black.
Oh, I know.
Now he's a broadcaster, he knows everything.
That wasn't that bad.
You know, there's a lot to chew on there.
There is a lot to chew on.
I want to do the first contract story, because that's always an interesting one.
Doug
did your deal?
Oh, my first deal was, you guys want to hear about a bad deal? It wasn't the second deal. The first deal I signed was a four-way.
A four-way?
You guys never even heard of a four-way.
The only one I heard of was the three-way Mark Giordano signed. His first contract was one salary NHL, one salary AHL, and one salary ECHL. They don't have those anymore.
And then he ended up saying screw it to all of it when he played with the Axar Ben Knights and went to the KHL. What's your story?
I am a proud member of the four-way club.
That's quite an exclusive group, I understand.
That's a very exclusive group, gentlemen.
There's the clip, Emil. There's the promo for the show.
Clip it.
What's the deal?
When I first was drafted by the Detroit Red Wings, took a couple times. I finally got drafted as a 19-year-old playing for the Kitchener Rangers. Seventh-round pick. Had to go back and play overage for the Windsor Spitfires for Brad Motor City Smitty.
Awesome
what an
guy.
Experience that
Great
was.
Mm-hmm.
That was fantastic. So then when I finally signed at the end of that overage season with Windsor, I was offered a contract. And I thought, you know, I was real excited to see it come across the fax machine back then because that's what we used. And I was like, okay, I have no problem talking to the cash. It was $120,000 to play for the Detroit Red Wings. And I'm like, $120,000? Unbelievable. Fax keeps going.
So this is 92?
We're talking 91? I was drafted in 1990. We're talking 91, 92.
Okay.
And then the second clause, if you play for the Adirondack Red Wings, it would be $30,000. Then the facts kept going down. Then it dropped down to $27,500 if I was going to play for the Fort Wayne Comets.
Legendary minor hockey team, by the way. Even if you play one game for the Comets, this would just be part of their alumni.
The I was good back then, too. So that was the I was an affiliate of the Red Wings as well. This is the best part of the story, Elliot. If I went down to the next league, was the East Coast League, which was a brand new league. I would make $22,500. But it wasn't the money I was worried about if I got sent there. The coach then of the Hampton Road Admirals, John Brophy.
Now, Brophy is legendary. And you played for a couple of legendary coaches.
I did.
And we're going to get to one of them who coached you with the Hamilton Steelhawks in a couple of seconds, Bill LaForge. But doesn't part of you regret never having the Brophy experience?
Well, yes and no, because who knows if you even get out of Hampton.
Yeah.
Road, whatever it was
Admirals.
Called. Like, it was a nice place, though. It was a pretty nice place.
Oh, it's a great area to live.
Yeah, it was nice. You'd have Brof, and, you know, Brof was old school, and the East Coast League back then was a jungle. Like, the American League was tough. The I was more of a skill league back then for older guys, but the East Coast League, that was a zoo. And I was...
Four-hour games,
and, like, there was no three fights and you're out.
Three fights and you get a bonus.
Three fights and you get a fourth.
Three fights or fans get a refund.
Exactly. So I credit John Brophy being there and helping me get to the NHL. Just fear of going down there. So that was my first contract with Doug McLean, the four-way contract.
So is that the one that he's referencing right now? The bad deal, the four-way deal?
That's probably the one.
Oh, Doug.
Now, how many times did you break curfew?
Only once that I got caught.
Okay, I like the clarifier there. Did Doug catch you?
Doug caught us because Doug was out too. And this was back when I was playing for the Adirondack Red Wings. Newell Brown was the coach.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some interesting characters in this story as well. One of them who is he's up and center right now in the NHL, is Florida Panthers team is battling right now.
Bobby Bugner,
Jamie Pusher. I believe there might have been a Marty Lapointe. A few other guys. Anyhow, this is a classic rookie mistake. I was a second-year American League player. If you're going to miss curfew, don't come in if it's 12 o'clock at 12:30. If you're going to be late, be really late. Because if you come in around 12:30, you never know who you're going to see. And we're walking in the lobby upstairs of the hotel in Hamilton. And we see Doug McLean coming up the escalator. All of a sudden, Jamie Pusher doesn't know what to do. He just stands there. I start running down the hall. Boogie jumps behind a plant. And so three of us get away, and Push is just standing there by himself. And Doug says, hey, Jamie, looks at his watch. How you doing? You can tell Bugner, York, Lapointe that I've seen those guys.
How was the next game?
Well, here's was his message. You tell those... You know what? If you guys don't win your game tomorrow, I'm sending you all down to the coast.
You're going to Brof.
That's a great story because I remember one NHL player who has asked me never to use his name when he tells this story. If I ever was to tell it, he said that there was a night where he went out and he admitted he was a guy who probably didn't take it seriously enough at times and it hurt his career. But he was out one night and he ran into the general manager. And the general manager said, you better be freaking great tomorrow night.
Well, here's the thing, too.
So I said, he didn't discipline you? He said, no, no, no. He told me I better be freaking great.
John Tortorella talked about this a few weeks ago.
Playing guilty.
Playing guilty has left the game now.
Yeah, it has. And here's the thing. None of us were really drinking that night or anything. We were just out a little bit after curfew, and it was one of those things, like, we were playing guilty because we were out, but none of us.
Helping the seniors with the groceries. Yeah, no.
Yeah, like, I was never one to go out and get bombed the night before a game or anything. I still don't know how guys do that.
There's a long tradition of that in the National Hockey
League. That's why the pregame skate exists.
Originally, yeah.
That's why.
There's a... I shouldn't say the player's name, so I won't. Great junior hockey story of someone who played in the NHL as a defenseman, mainly in the Eastern Conference. It's about as far as I can go with this one. He's playing junior in the Quebec League, and curfew, I think, was 10 o'clock. And he gets to his girlfriend's house around 8:30, and it's 9 o'clock, it's 9:15, it's 9:20, it's 9:30. And his girlfriend says, you know, you live across town. Like, there's no way you're going to make it home. Your coach is going to call, and you're going to get busted for curfew, which, as you can imagine, and you went through playing in the OHL, is pretty significant in junior hockey when you bust curfew. This player said, don't worry about it. I got it covered. And this is the era before cell phones. And so he goes into his gym bag, and he pulls out a phone, right? And he says, I brought this phone from my billet's house. I'll plug it in, and when the coach calls, he'll think I'm at home. And he got nabbed. But I think that was the moment that his girlfriend said, there's a distinction to be made. There's dumb, and then there's hockey dumb. And that was
that one gives hockey players dumb. A bad name. Oh, boy.
That was clearly hockey dumb. Okay, one more thing about Adirondack. You were part of maybe the greatest Calder Cup final of all time. This is 1991? Adirondack, St. John's.
Yes.
It was a final where a home team never won a game.
Yep.
Every game was won on the road.
Did you guys win? I don't remember.
Yeah, Adirondack won. Beat St. John's at mile one.
Yeah, I love that story. Doug McLean's also a part of that story as well, because it's a different story, going a little off track, but Doug was our assistant GM and also involved with the Detroit Red Wings. But in the minors, this is a little, it's a well-kept secret. When you're in the minors, you don't want your NHL team to win, because if they win in the playoffs, everyone's happy.
So true.
When you're in the minors, you want the NHL team to be miserable.
Yep.
Look what's going on with the Ottawa Senators right now, the Montreal Canadiens.
Everybody in Belleville is cheering what's happening in the nation's capital.
Because you're going to get a chance to play. That's how careers start. How many guys broke in on those Edmonton Oilers or New York Islanders teams? Nobody, because they won.
Yeah.
So we're down in the bar, and Detroit's playing. I forget who they're playing. It might have been San Jose, and they were losing. And every time San Jose would score, there would be a little cheer, but not too loud, because Doug was sitting there, and he goes, what are you guys cheering about? I could lose my job over this. And I'm like, we could get one.
Players never talk about this, the idea of cheering against the parent team.
Also, I think you're making a big mistake there. Why would you be in the same bar as the coach or executive?
It's the minors. That's how it works in the minors. It was a day game, too. We were there having a team, I believe it was like a team meal or something.
Day drinking always goes great for hockey
teams.
Fantastic.
Well, listen, back in the days in the AHL in the early 90s, there was a lot of that going on.
Maybe I'm just too fixated on this point because we never hear it so much about players actively cheering for...
Absolutely.
I don't know if you cheer for injuries, but hey, listen, it's an opportunity. You cheer for losses. It's your organization. Sure, I get that. But this is your career you're looking after here.
When you're a professional athlete, even though you're playing a team sport, your enterprise is you. So you're in charge of your body and everything you can do to get to where you want to be as the NHL. And unless you're a first rounder, a high first rounder, you're going to have the red carpet rolled out. You need a break.
Mm-hmm.
You need something to happen, an injury, a team's playing poorly. Otherwise, especially nowadays, rosters are so young in the National Hockey League, you don't have old guys hanging out in the third and fourth line and the sixth and seventh D. A lot of teams, like, it's tough to get in.
So when you were playing in the NHL, and if you were ever in a situation where you were an extra player, like the 22nd or 23rd man, did you root for bad games by your teammates or guys to get not a serious injury, but like something?
Never an injury, but when you're in the NHL, you're happy, especially when you're a young guy. You're just happy to be there at the beginning, but you want to play because sitting in the stands is going to do you no good.
Mm-hmm.
So you're hoping for an opportunity. And if that comes from an injury or a guy getting hurt, you're not happy for that. But that's your shot. Listen, the NHL is a cutthroat business. We all know that. It's cutthroat with coaching, and it's cutthroat with players. And that's the thing. You're teammates with these guys, but at the same time, you're competitors. That's why I was always best friends with the backup goalie.
Why?
Not competing with them.
Now, how quickly at the end of a game would you grab the game sheet to see who was a dash?
Not really.
you weren't that fanatic about it. Hey, this guy's dash four. What the heck?
Some guys are. Some guys are. I didn't really check. You kind of know. I was one of those players, too. I knew exactly how I played, what I did, what mistakes I made, what I needed to do better. Like, I was so almost it's amazing because I wasn't a great math student, but I knew exactly every hand, every player I played against shot. I knew tendencies of players. I knew the time on the clock. Like, I knew.
You were that guy, eh?
I was in my head because I had to be that guy because I wasn't super fast. I wasn't super big, so you had to be smart. Like Doug said, I was smart.
Mm. What was the most...
We all are now, apparently.
Exactly.
What was the most cutthroat thing you can remember, whether it happened to you or somebody else? The most cutthroat business thing that stood out to you?
While you think about that, one of the great stories that Clint Malarchuk tells is after Steve Tuttle cut his throat with the skate in that accident in Buffalo, the St. Louis
so
St. Louis Buffalo Sabres game, and he came back, and by his own admission, way too soon. So whenever you say the word cutthroat, I always think of this. He told me, this is on the air, not off the air, and he's told the story before as well. He said, the next time we played St. Louis, you know, we're skating around in warm-up, and I can tell that Tuttle is like, oh, I don't know what to say. Like, how do you begin to like apologize or say something to him? And they got to center ice and they sort of paused, and Tuttle approached him, and Clint said, I could tell he was really nervous and didn't know what to say, and I said I had to break the ice, and so all I said was, dude, you're cutthroat.
Oh.
And he said after that became best of friends. Anyway, go ahead, Jason.
Like cutthroat. I'm surprised now. Like, we're in a different era. Like,
yeah,
there's been so many things that I've heard said on the ice with players back in the day where it was just left on the ice, but it was nasty, nasty stuff.
Kevin McClelland was the best, true or false?
He was the scariest.
As far as beaking from the bench.
The old Edmonton Oiler?
Yeah, and the Detroit Red Wing.
With the crazy eyes?
Oh, yeah.
He was in that Adirondack
St.
John series. I was actually a little bit afraid of him. He had those crazy eyes? Like, he was one of those guys, because back, you go back to the early 90s, mid-90s, there were guys that could really hurt you. And that's why star players were safe, because these types of guys, like a Kevin McClelland, like a Bob Probert, like a Stu Grimson. Stu Grimson, funny story. Talk about smart guys.
Where?
Cutthroat things said to you by different players. Stu, as you guys know, is very intelligent. So if he's going to say something to you, he's going to use big words. And one game I was playing against the Anaheim Mighty Ducks. Paul Cree and I are very good friends. I played with Paul. So every time I'd play against him, I would try and hit him. You know, clean and stuff, but I'd go after him. And then I skated by their bench, and there's Grimson. He stands up. He goes, next time you touch Korea, I'm going to rip your esophagus out.
Oh!
I'm like, did you just say the word esophagus?
When's esophagus ever going to be used as a chirp before?
Well,
the
hockey player is a lawyer.
Uh-huh. Maybe the most cutthroat business thing you saw. You talk about a cutthroat league.
Oh, you want to go there?
Yeah.
signing in Anaheim as a free agent and playing there in my first year as for Brian Murray with the coach, I had played that entire season with a torn shoulder. I had hurt it early in the year to the point where I couldn't even lift my arm up. And I remember Tom Watt, who was our assistant coach, coming by 6 weeks later in practice and saying, Yorkie, what's wrong with you? He goes, you're not hitting anybody. I'm like, Tom, I go, I can't lift my arm up. So I basically played that entire season with one arm. And Brian Murray would say, listen, I really appreciate your playing hurt. We had a tough year that year. We missed the playoffs, and that was my first year there signing as a free agent. The next year at training camp, it was Mike Babcock's first year as the coach. And Brian had become the GM. Pierre Gauthier had been fired. And I went to camp that next year. Shoulder was still bad, but I had worked really hard that summer to build all the muscles up around it, and I was in great shape. Won all the fitness testing. I was ready to go. Wanted to have a bounce-back year, and I showed up for camp. And I'll never forget this. On day two, Mike Babcock told the team, things are going to be different this year. I'm going to divide you guys into an AHL group and an NHL group in day two of training camp. So I came to the rink. I was one of the top free agent signings the year before. I'd played hurt. I'm ready for a big year. I show up to the rink, and my name is on the AHL group. First thing I do, I barge into Babcock's office. What are you doing? I'm like, is this how you treat a guy that shows up and is in great shape? And Bab said, don't worry, you're going to be in the line. It's just, I'm just trying to shock the rest of the group. So what ended up happening is myself and a couple other players, German Titoff and Denny Lambert, talk about cutthroat. they were in the same boat. They had played the year before. We were told on day two of training camp that we were no longer welcome to practice with the team in training camp. We had to get our own ice.
What?
Practice at 1 p.m. and while the other team had training camp. So I was lucky because my career could have been over. Denny Lambert never played another game of hockey. And the year before, Denny Lambert had about 25 fights for Brian Murray. German Titov was a very good player, but all three of us had signed contracts under Pierre Gauthier the year before. And the writing was on the wall. And you know how it works in the business. Yeah. When a new GM comes in, he wants to make the other guy look as bad as possible. So I was waived. My wife just had a baby. I had a young family. Sent to Cincinnati. Not the worst thing. Had to go down there. But anyhow, I had to rebuild my reputation as a good player. Lucky enough, Ray Shiro saw me in a game and traded for me for a dollar.
Hey, work for Chris Draper.
It's okay.
Work yeah, for Chris there you go. But the worst, the cutthroat part of the story is Denny Lambert never played another game in the NHL, and neither did German Titov. And it was all, in my opinion, to make another GM look bad, because all three of us were still NHL players.
You know, it's interesting, too. Whenever you see a new coach take over a team, this happens, you know, 9 times out of 10. One of the first things that'll come out of his mouth is, oh, this team is out of shape. Always. And I always think the same thing. I always think the same thing, Jason, that you're talking about. When you try to make the other general manager look bad. Yeah. In this case, you're also buying yourself some time. It's like, oh, I need to work with these guys. But first, I got to get these guys in shape.
The best part of the story, though, Elliot, is I was mad for a long time at Brian Murray. A long time. And then obviously Brian passed away recently. And a testament to the type of guy Brian was. He was such a good guy. I couldn't stay mad at him.
You know, I got to tell you, Jason, like I have a thick skin and a long fuse.
Yeah.
But I hold grudges.
I did for a long time. So do
I. I hold grudges. I understand this business that you got to have a thick skin and you're going to battle with people. And sometimes they're going to lie to you. And sometimes they're going to be mad at you. And one of my closest friends in the business, we had a big blow up last week. But I said, look, we've had a good relationship for a decade. We're going to throw it away for 10 bad minutes. No, we're not doing that. But if you really screw me, I never forget. I don't know. Like, it's funny. Like, Jason, if that happened to me, I don't know if I would have ever.
Well, basically, my career was almost ended. And the thing that gets me, if I was not working and being one of those players, but the year before, it was a season where I played hurt the entire year. And I came to camp the next year ready to go. So to me, it was so... What's the word I'm looking for? It still makes me angry to this day. I was mad at Mike Babcock for a long time. But the best part is they both blamed each other. I asked Babs. He said it was Brian's idea. I asked Brian. He said it was Babs' idea.
Of course.
But, you know, time heals all wounds and you move on. But I was mad for a long time.
I believe it.
Before we get to a comment here from Mark Savard, because you played with Boston after the lockout. And you went and played in the Swiss League. In the lockout.
HC Lugano.
Okay. What was the lockout like for you? This is the big one, 204-05. This is scorched earth on the season. We're getting the head of Bob Goodenow and we're getting a salary cap,
boys.
Yeah,
it sucked.
Elliot lived it, covered it. I was on the radio while this was.
Oh, man.
At what point did you feel that the players were like, okay, we've had enough?
Was it
before or after that February 14th, Valentine's Day, Saskin Daily?
Yeah, I went to that meeting.
You went to that?
Sorry, I was at the one at the Harbor Castle when things got heated and a lot of guys were there. Just a lot of guys just saying, well, because it was the big thing was the salary cap, right? It's like, well, we're not taking a cap. Okay, we'll take a cap. It's like all this fighting.
I'm curious, so what did Goodenow tell you guys? Because I was always under the impression that they're going to fight for a cap. Are you guys prepared to sit out 1 year? Came back, yes. Are you prepared to sit out 2 years?
Yeah. One thing hockey players are very good at is doing what they're told. And that's what we did back then, and guys believed it. And one thing Bob Goodenow did say, which has rung true today, he had this term, it was called, I don't know if you'll remember this, Ellie, it was called Stars Over Kansas. He said the NHL will turn into Stars Over Kansas, which means the star players will get paid and everybody else won't, which there's still guys getting paid, but
the death of the middle class in the NHL.
The middle class. Yeah. And the difficult part of that is you watch an NHL playoff, who wins you cups? Middle class. The teams with good third lines, those depth guys, the Nick Boninos of the world, those are the guys. But back then, it was a tough time for a lot of careers ended.
Yeah.
But that's what you do as a hockey player. You're told when to go to the rink, what to do, what to eat, how to play. And that's why pro athletes in general struggle when they're done playing. They just, they're so used to being on a schedule and being told what to do.
You know, it's funny you say that because Bob Goodenough also used to tell people, and I'm starting to hear it again now from the Players Association, that the toughest players to convince to stay with it were the Canadians because they felt the most pressure and they were probably the ones that followed orders the most.
Yeah, for sure.
Do you buy that?
The most media scrutiny because you're
everywhere they go.
Everywhere you go, the fans would be saying stuff to players. And at the time I was playing for the Nashville Predators, I had just finished up a contract and it was awful timing for me coming off a contract and going into a lockout. Personally, for me, I didn't have a deal coming out of that lockout and coming off a couple, I had a couple more injuries after that. So I had to wait. And that's one of the reasons I ended up going overseas to Switzerland. All I remember with the lockout, it was brutal. My dad passed away in 05. So the whole year just sucked. It was not great memories. And then coming back, you know, I like the way the league is now. I like the changes and the games. I think the game's much better.
Mm-hmm. You ended up getting a contract with the Boston Bruins. And that was, you know, one of the teams, and maybe they were Exhibit A, who thought that the smartest thing to do after a lockout is have as few contracts as possible.
Yeah.
The opposite turned out to be true. But I don't know how Boston only had a handful of contracts, I think, at that point. And that ended up being the team that you signed with.
Not a very good team.
That leads us to Mark Savard, further to that point.
Jason York, the worst stick taper of all time. Got my pleasure to play with him during the 2006-07 season and was very disappointed when I saw him on the first day with a stick that looked like probably your best road hockey stick that you have, tape slanted up a bit at the bottoms.
Yep.
Just a horrific job that I basically started taping his sticks without even asking him because I was so disgusted. And my other story about him, this is a good one. We're playing in Boston, and it wasn't our greatest year, 2006-07. I just came over from Atlanta, and Yorkie's on our team, great guy. We got along well. And we're having a tough season that year. We were pretty much in the bottom two, three of the league that year. And Yorkie comes to me one day and he's like, "Savvy, man, I love the way you work the wall in the power play. I think me and you would have just a great connection." We had Dave Lewis as a coach then. And he said, "Do you mind talking to Dave, getting me out there on the first PP with you?" and of course, being the nice guy I was, I said, "Yeah, Yorkie, you know what? It couldn't hurt. We weren't doing well at the time." So of course I go into Dave's office the next day and I said, "Dave," I said, "Yorkie and me had a chat, and we think it'd be beneficial if Yorkie can come on the first power play. And he would help me out back there. He's that off shot. You know, we work it back and forth." And Louis looked at me and he said, "Savvy, we're in second last in the league. Our power play's third overall. Tell Yorkie to relax and get out of my office." So I left the office, and I didn't realize till right this moment. I looked at Yorkie's stats. He played 49 games that year. He had one goal, 7 assists for 8 points, and he won it on the first unit. So I didn't have much to go in the office with, but it ended up being a good story, if anything.
Remember that conversation?
I don't remember that. That's a good story.
So it's possible it's actually true.
Possibly. We were so bad that year. Mm-hmm. We were a team. We had a rookie, Phil Kessel, Savvy. It was Daniel Chera's first year in Boston as the captain. He was figuring things out.
Was it true Lewis wouldn't let him fight that year?
It's a good question.
I think Dave said, no, the gloves stay cemented on. And he was always like, "I need one or two just to get out of my system."
I think he recommended that Z not fight, but he still had a couple scraps. And boy, when he fought, I still say he's, even at 40, the guy in the league nobody wants to fight.
Yeah.
Ever tell you my theory on Chera? Every year. For as long as he's been in the NHL, there's one award he should have won, and it shouldn't have even been close.
What's that?
Lady Bing. Yeah. Not for what he does, but what he has the potential to do.
Yeah, you and I spoke about this.
He has the potential to lay waste to the entire league and doesn't.
Mm-hmm. Well,
that, to me, is the most gentlemanly player in the NHL. If he wanted, he could maim guys and end careers.
He's
Shrek.
Everybody remembers the McCabe round.
Yeah.
Round and round he went, and that's a 225-pound man at the time, Brian McCabe, who was working out with Gary Roberts, was extremely strong, and the Big Z treated him like he was a child.
Yeah.
And he was mad that time, that's why. But to your testament, Jeff, if Zdeno does get angry, it doesn't happen often, look out, because I think he does hold back, because he could seriously hurt somebody. Well, you saw it. Well, the Max Pacioretty play.
Yeah.
And that wasn't even full force.
Yeah.
Who are your favorite teammates? Like your the guys you like playing with the most.
Wade Redden.
Yeah.
Mike Sillinger.
Mm-hmm.
Andreas Johansson.
You traded for Sillinger. You're one of the legendaries.
Traded together.
Mm-hmm.
You're not. You haven't lived until you've been traded with Mike Sillinger.
Fair enough. Okay.
He holds the record, doesn't he?
I think it's 11.
Played with Wade Redden for a long time. Andreas Johansson, played with him in Nashville and mm-hmm. Ottawa. Still keep in touch. Mark Savard was a great teammate. Savvy and I only played 1 year together.
Mm-hmm.
Daniel Alfredson was a great teammate.
Mm-hmm.
I wish I could have spent more time in Detroit. I was there as a rookie, and I got a time to play with some pretty big names like a Paul Coffey, who was a short time, but mm-hmm. being a young defenseman and getting a chance to play with Paul Coffey is a pretty big thrill.
And what do you peel away from that when you're playing with someone?
So funny. So many one-liners.
Oh, really?
So, like, you talk to guys that are done, and I don't remember a lot of plays. I remember the stuff in the dressing room. I remember what guys said. I remember some of the funny nuances. One of Coff's biggest things, if I would do something that caught his eye, he'd look at me and say, "It's pretty good, kid. Put that in the book when I write it."
Well, that would be quite a book when he decides he wants to write that.
Oh, he's such a funny guy.
Who's your favorite growing up?
Favorite player? I loved Mike Bossy. I loved Doug Wilson as a defenseman, but I always played goal in road hockey. And I was Chico Rush or Rogie Vacher.
Oh, wow. was it Rogie because of 76, the Canada Cup?
I don't know. I just liked him. I loved Rogie Vacher for some reason. Chico Rush. And I've got a great picture. Chico, got to meet Chico when I was playing in Ottawa, and he was broadcasting for the Devils. Chico sent me a picture. I still got it in the office. Chico was great when he played.
Yeah.
And Doug Wilson being an Ottawa guy, mm-hmm. a big clapper from
big
the plate.
Big slap shot.
Yeah, no helmet.
Yeah.
Wow.
My parents were Montreal fans, but tried to force it on me, but I was more of an independent thinker.
Well, I wanted to ask you about Ottawa, because you live in Ottawa.
Yeah.
You obviously have a close relationship with a love for the Senators. This year, what do you think? I worry about the impact that this year is going to have on
mess.
The long-term future of the Ottawa Senators.
It's an absolute mess what's going on in Ottawa right now. That's what I think. It's too bad, because that franchise, from where it started... You guys can remember in year one, I believe Sports Illustrated had an article that was the worst franchise in all of sports. Remember that?
Yep.
How bad it was? And look at the strides. And I look back on the years I was there for five straight years. It was the first year that franchise ever made the playoffs. We made it 5 years in a row. And those were building block years. And then the big years came when I left. Those years they went to the Cup and they played Anaheim. And that fan base there was so strong. They always had a chip on their shoulder, too, because they have the Toronto complex. And they have that thing going on. But the fans there are great. And now to see where it's gone, and it's unfortunate. I still think they've got a great fan base there. They're just very angry right now. They're very angry with ownership. They're very angry with what's gone on. And I still think it can be salvaged. Absolutely. Like, I know.
How do you fix it?
Number one, you got to figure out what you're doing with Erik Karlsson. That's number one. And
I don't know if that's their decision.
Yeah, that's a good point. And the relationship that was been fractured with Daniel Alfredson. You look at look at the Chicago Blackhawks. That team franchise was a mess. What was one of the first things the Chicago Blackhawks did to help repair that fan base?
Bring back all the legends.
Bring back. And I'm not saying the Ottawa Senators have legends, but there were some great steps made at Parliament Hill that night. And it was a great night when all the alumni came out. Alfredson was there. Yashin came back. Daigle was there. And the people were happy. And not having your greatest player in franchise, Daniel Alfredson, part of the franchise, mm-hmm. like, he lives in Ottawa.
Mm-hmm.
But that's something that needs to be repaired.
If you think about it, Jason, all their great players, nobody's left there on good terms.
Heatley, Yashin,
Alfredson, Chara. Well, Zdeno was mad. I remember we did a piece with him, and he was angry. He said he never got an offer.
Wasn't that Muckler making decisions?
Yes.
We have X amount of dollars. We're taking Redden.
But he was mad he never got an offer.
I thought he got an offer for $6 million. They offered him and Redden the same thing.
He claims that he never got an offer.
He never got it. Well, he would know.
And he's no liar.
I do know this, that Zdeno Chara wanted to be a captain of an NHL team.
Mm-hmm.
I do know that Zdeno Chara didn't see eye to eye with Danny Heatley and Jason Spezza. You know, there's two totally different personalities.
Mm-hmm.
The way Heatley prepares for a season, the way Zdeno Chara, and I never asked Z this is just my gut on it, He wanted to go to Boston. He wanted it to be Zdeno Chara's team. It was never going to be Zdeno's team in Ottawa. It was Daniel Alfredson's team.
Mm.
Why wouldn't you go to the Boston Bruins, make 7-5? Part of that deal was he was promised the captaincy. Why wouldn't you take that?
Does he have...
That's interesting. I never heard the captaincy part.
Does he have a sense of history about the Boston Bruins and defensemen? Because whether... I mean, you go all the way back to Eddie Shore and Orr and Brad Park and Raymond Bourque and like... Bruins fans have been spoiled in that they've always...
Now look what they got coming, Charlie McAvoy.
And Charlie McAvoy now. They've always had an elite defenseman on the roster.
Yeah.
Like an all-star, like a first...
Yeah. It's funny how...
All-star on the... Would that factor into all of, like, I'm going to be part of this lineage? Gord Kluzak could have been that guy,
too. I would think so. He's a very sharp guy, and you guys have heard the stories of him. Like, he's gone back to school. He's got some degrees. He's not just a hockey player. He's very educated.
He has a real estate license.
What I remember about him, too, was that we did a piece on Al Arbor when the Islanders brought Al Arbor back to coach his 1,000th game. And Al Arbor and Claire Arbor, they lived in Sarasota. And one day he said the phone rang, and it was this deep, deep voice. And it turned out Zdeno Chara lived not far away from them in the summers. And he called up Al Arbor and said, I'm going to be the captain of the Boston Bruins, and I want you to tell me what makes a good captain. And he came over to their place and spent an afternoon there.
Yeah.
So I'm not surprised to hear that.
In Zdeno's first year as captain, I remember he got to Boston 2 weeks early, and he was running unofficial team workouts, and he took it very serious. That doesn't surprise me. He's that type of guy, mm-hmm. like super focused, super serious. He was actually, in my opinion, at the beginning, I think he really learned how to become a captain. That year was a struggle, and then he made some tweaks later on, and he's had a great great run in Boston and still going strong. What is he, 40 now?
Yeah, and they're probably going to sign him for another year.
Why wouldn't you?
Is he just going to be on evergreen contracts at this point? Just 1 year, 1 year, 1 year,
I'm
one
sure,
year?
You never know. Like, I'm sure he'd love a two-year deal, but I'm sure the team would want one. Yeah.
Sharp turn here.
Okay.
Whenever someone plays for Bill LaForge, I can't pass it up.
Okay.
Now, Bill LaForge
we going
was,
there, Jeff?
We are, man. Legendary coach in the...
I went into therapy for this year.
Yeah, a lot of players have. A lot of players have. Brief stint as head coach of the Vancouver Canucks. Coach a little out in the Western Hockey League, but coached the majority of his career in the OHL with Hamilton. One season with Guelph and Niagara Falls. You had him in Hamilton. One day we'll tell the story on this show about him putting body bags in the dressing room for the Kitchener Rangers. But we won't tell that story today, but we'll use that as an on-ramp to get to Jason York's craziest story about Bill LaForge.
I could write a book on my OHL experiences with Bill LaForge.
Yeah.
I was their first round draft pick, and I was going into this situation very naive, very wide-eyed. Growing up in Ottawa, I didn't even go to Ottawa 67's games. My older brother...
Really, eh?
No, my older brother got a scholarship.
It would have been a good team, though. It was a Bobby Smith.
I was busy playing road hockey, doing my own thing. I didn't really watch a lot of hockey, to tell you the truth. I played a lot of hockey. That's what I did. And my brother got a scholarship. That's what I thought I was going to do. He went to Princeton, and I was going to not go to Princeton, but hopefully get a scholarship. So ended up getting drafted to Hamilton. Go play there. Very first day of training camp, LaForge has us working out in the field, and we're playing, I don't even know what this game is called, but it's basically a circle forms around everybody, and two guys have to go in and fight each other in the grass and try and pin the other guy. So we had the tournament, and the guy that ended up winning then had to wrestle LaForge.
Are you serious? Bill got down with him? Oh, my God.
Yes.
You know what? I'd rather finish second.
I'm just warming up here, boys. I'm just warming up.
I'm just having a look at your roster from then. So was it Dennis Vial that ended up winning?
Dennis Vial, he created Paul Lowe. Bill LaForge created Paul Lowe. Paul Lowe is one of the most underrated fighters of his generation.
Very seldom did I ever see Paul Lowe cut.
Oh, boy.
Never.
I was the first rounder. Paul was the second rounder. Keith Primo was drafted in the fifth round that year. So the three of us were there. Primes ended up going down to play Junior B for most of that year. So Paul and I were the only lone rookies. And craziest story, I would say, would be what LaForge referred to as Hell Week.
Okay.
To start off the playoffs, he said, we are going to have Hell Week to get us ready for the playoffs. You know, two-a-days?
Yep.
We went three-a-days. And we're in high school students. I'm going to school. So we had to be at the rink at 6 a.m. for a 7 a.m. practice, then off to school you went after to get to school for 8:30, back at lunch to do special teams, and then again after school at 4:30 for your third practice. It's 3 days. Also part of Hell Week, Bill LaForge brought in a new rule during practice. On the first whistle it is blown down, you stop the drill and you go get a water break. If you ever hear two whistles being blown, tweet, tweet, you drop your gloves and fight the closest guy to you.
That sounds like Bill.
You know, now you do that, you're going to jail.
Like, oh, are you kidding?
Two whistle drill, drop the gloves.
This is a five-part series on CBC.
So I'm like 17 years old. I'm scared. I'm like, is this for real? Like, are we really fighting here?
Yeah.
All of a sudden, I'm like, drop your gloves. I'm looking. I'm like, okay, don't go for Dennis Vial. Avoid Dennis Vial. Avoid Paul Louse. Where's Garth Joy? Where's Garth Joy? Garth Joy is like our overage who's about 5'10", 170, great guy. Garth, get over here. And then I look over, Dennis Vial is just going toe-to-toe with somebody. It was insane. The two whistle drill.
Mayday told me, Brad May told me that when he was with LaForge, he had this thing about, I think it was 100 hits. He had to have 100 hits a night. And if
50.
He did,
50?
50 hits. Have to have 50
hits. And who counted
hits.
Them? Like, that was always the thing, too. What really counted as a hit?
As a hit. But it had to be, like, solid collisions.
So in the dressing room, we had the big number 50 painted up on the wall in the dressing room. And after you sang this ridiculous chant we had to say before every game, it was this Billy's Boys song that he made up. And it was basically a song about fighting and doing whatever you could for the coach and the team. And then as you walked out, you had to pound your fist on the number 50, which meant you're all in to get 50 hits that game. So if the team lost and you didn't get 50 hits as a team,
yep,
trouble was coming. Next day at practice, the net would be moved back. So there was only about 4 feet of space behind that net, maybe a little more. Enough for two lines. So if you can picture this in your mind, at the blue line, offensive zone facing in. On the whistle, a guy from each line goes. You're heading towards the behind the net, going, full-on collision behind the net. And he goes, if you're not going to get your 50 in the game, we'll get it here at practice.
And that was one.
That was one.
Next two.
If you didn't, and if you didn't do it hard enough, go again.
Oh.
So guys, there were guys that would actually hurt their shoulders in this drill. I remember myself, I was just nervous. I was actually scared to go to the rink. I'd get to practice. He'd be skating up and down the ice, yelling at me. One time I remember going home. I was at my billet's house, sitting there, rattled from the day's work. Phone rings. It's actually the assistant coach that called me that night. What a beauty this guy was.
York, coach here. Next day at practice, if a guy goes around you, I want you to slash him so hard, you break his arm.
Oh, jeez. Really?
Yep.
Okay, I'll see you tomorrow.
Did you do it?
No. Just crazy. It was craziness.
So 30 years later, your boy, Jack, is playing in the Ontario Hockey League.
Yeah.
Kitchener Rangers.
I would never in my life send him to the Ontario League if that was going on now.
Well, I was just going to say, like, you know, now the world is so different.
Yeah. And that was...
Is it better or is it worse? And by worse, I'm saying, like, the only reason... And I know that sounds insane. As we just, but no, but like...
Okay,
By worse in the sense that, like, you know, now... The exposure to social media, there's different challenges.
There's different challenges. To the flip side of all this, guys, my second year junior, I got traded to the Windsor Spitfires. Jim Rutherford was the GM. Mm-hmm. Tom Webster was the head coach. Peter DeBoer was our captain. Mm-hmm. Paul Maurice, it's his first year coaching. He was 21 years old. He was my D coach. I had the best experience ever in junior hockey. Mm-hmm. And that was the same era. Mm-hmm. It was just that Hamilton team was just run like a crazy, it was a madhouse.
Mm-hmm. Psycho.
It was psycho. And it was brainwashing of young kids. Like, it was really bad. He would have went to jail. He really would have.
Oh, if it were now?
Now? So now, 30 years later, how does it compare? You're a father. Anybody out here is listening as a father or a mother.
Yeah.
You know, all you care about is that your kid gets treated properly. And when you let them out of your sight and you hand them to someone else, you're taking a leap.
Well, all I can tell you is what's with my son this year in Kitchener. It's amazing. You get letters and emails from the team secretary on team schedules and road trips. You've got the school education advisors contacting you. You're up to date on everything. Your billet houses are great. Like, fantastic people. The exposure of that league, it's totally different now. Mm-hmm. Like the OHL, in my opinion, now is like a mini NHL. Mm-hmm. Like the facility these teams have now, Kitchener's facility is unbelievable. It's as nice as almost some NHL setups. It's crazy. It's a different world. The Windsor experience, I will say, guys, was fantastic. Mm-hmm. And we didn't have the best of the best. We played in that old...
Yeah, that old rink.
That old Windsor
box.
Arena.
Oh, yeah.
But for me, it's all about good people. Mm-hmm. And I had good people around me when I was a young, impressionable guy. And I went from wanting to quit hockey my first year junior to loving the game and being a kid that got 13 points as a rookie to 64. It's like anything, guys.
Yeah.
It's the people in your environment that make it good.
Mm-hmm. And that to a multi-year NHL career and now one of the smartest men on television, according to Doug McClain.
And now a podcast guest, which is, I know, the pinnacle.
Now you've hit zenith.
You might as well just quit and retire.
Thanks, Jason.
You're welcome.
Sportsnet.ca, your online home for everything sports. Dunks, dives, and deeks. Catch highlights, news, and the best storytelling in Canada. Featuring all the stories you want to read in one place. Plus, exclusive podcasts including 31 Thoughts and At the Letters. Canada's deepest roster of storytellers. Sportsnet.ca, your online home for everything sports.
By the way, Elliot, the music you're hearing right now, this is a band that was on the podcast last week that I've gone down this musical audio wormhole with, Scenic Route to Alaska. This is a song called, I have to say this now because we get so many tweets about it, especially about this band. This is a song called Coming Back. It's not from the new album, which is called Tough Luck, but this is a song called Coming Back, which has a really sweet video to it. And they're coming here on the 21st. Is that right, Emil? I'm going. I will be there. So this is, again, Scenic Route to Alaska, the track Coming Back. The new album's called Tough Luck. There you go. Jason York, want to thank him for stopping by.
Yep.
Wonderful guy. You know, he's one of those guys. We've talked a lot about players that have made the transition from playing to broadcasting. And I know I'm going to paint with a wide brush here, but a lot of the guys think they can surf on the rep. I played in the NHL. I should know everything, and I won't do the homework, and I won't pay attention every single night. And I won't read and I won't make my phone calls because I played in the NHL for 15 years, so I know everything. Yorkie's not one of those guys.
You know what's really funny about that? It's funny you bring that up. And you're right. Yorkie does the work. I was talking to Sean Thornton this week because the kids from the Parkland School, the Florida Panthers, and Swift Air got them the private plane to go up to the high school championships
in
Minneapolis.
So good.
And they got the full food experience on the way there. The kids are getting to pick the menu on the way back. So they want the chicken fingers and fries. They can have those. But PJ Stock, our buddy, who is tight with Sean Thornton, told me that late in Thornton's career, he wanted to go into media and he wanted to become an insider. That was Sean Thornton's goal. He
really
wanted to go into media and be an insider and break trades. So when I was on this conversation with Thornton, I said to him, I heard that that's what you wanted to do. And he laughed and he said, that is true. I did want to do that. And he said, don't take this personally, but I didn't think it was going to be that time consuming. Like
that
I didn't realize
to check everything.
I didn't realize how hard that was. Now he actually told me, like he's chosen a good route through the business.
Yep.
But he also said that when he was in Boston, he would go into the sales department and sit around and just watch the way they do their jobs. I guess there's a woman there by the name of Amy Latimer that she kind of took him under his wing.
Yeah.
And showed him, like, this is why we do this, and this is how we do this. And he said he really was interested in that, and now he's doing that. Like the other day, when I spoke to him, I said, can we talk at 4? And he goes, I can't do 4. I have a conference call with the UFC at that time. So I hope I'm not speaking out of school here. But he goes to me, so let's do 2. But He said that, yes, he did think about it, but he chose to go into business instead. He really likes it.
Okay, so he wasn't one of those guys you see come trade deadline time with the Hockey Insider Twitter feed?
No, I don't believe he was. Maybe he was throwing stuff out there that we don't know. That would have been even funnier. He said, like, honestly, it was a consideration once. You know what I told him? I said, you could always come back to doing that, and you'll make more contacts doing what he's doing now.
Mm-hmm. It's funny, we always talk about, you know, the TV doors are open for Chris Pronger. Like, whenever you're ready, Mr. Pronger, TV will take you. Do you throw Sean Thornton in that mix as well?
We've talked about this. Sean Thornton, Kevin Bieksa, Scott Hartnell. I think Scott Upshaw would be a guy who's good at it, too. I think they've got, you know, I think there's a few guys.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really do.
Let me get your thoughts on a couple of more things here.
Okay.
The Donald Trump tax plan.
Yes.
Let's not spend too much on this because I don't want to. I can already hear the eyes glazing.
No, I think this is good because it's the first time a Donald Trump proposal or provision could affect the NHL.
So essentially, it's a capital gains issue, and the idea is with the new tax bill that if you gain something and don't send something commensurate the other way, you have accrued a capital gain and are therefore eligible to be taxed on it.
Well, basically the story is I saw in the New York Times on Monday, it's in the politics section by a reporter named Jim Tankersley. It's entitled "A Curveball from the New Tax Law. It Makes Baseball Trades Harder." And basically you explained it. It's something that went after farmers, manufacturers, and other businesses that could swap certain assets like trucks and machinery tax-free. And they've changed that.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was that Major League Baseball and the National Basketball Association were warned by their leagues that this could affect trades. So since I was down at the NHL GMs meetings, I asked the league, does this affect you? And I was told yes. They had also made their teams aware. But they just don't know at this point in time. But they felt it was important to let their teams know that this is something else that could potentially be an issue.
Considering it affects sports in the United States in a significant way, I have a hard time seeing this ever come to pass. Because you're talking about sacred things. You're talking about baseball. You're talking about football. I have a hard time believing that would be a popular element in the tax bill for United States citizens who are baseball/football fans. Don't you?
Well, it's pretty funny. And you know what? You said it right before. Next year, our trade deadline show. Sorry, there's no trades because.
Yeah, Trump ruined trade deadline. We'll still be up at 8 o'clock, though.
Yes.
Regardless of what Donald Trump's tax bill does,
yes,
we're still
going to
be up at 8 o'clock on the air spinning plates. You had a chat with Marco Sturm.
Yes.
Has he had a chance to watch the game yet?
No, he said he's not going to. He said he's not at that point.
Oh.
You know, it was interesting. You know, like, in the 2004 Olympics, I did interviews on the pool deck, and one of the people I worked with was Marianne Limpert.
Yep.
And Marianne Limpert won a silver medal for Canada in 96 in Atlanta in the 200-meter individual medley. And she said the toughest places to finish at the Olympics were silver and fourth, because silver is you lose to the gold medal and fourth, it's
just
obvious how brutal it is.
Yeah.
And so I told Sturm that, and he said, I totally understand where she's coming from. Because you remember, I thought the thing that really stood out was after they lost, how he pulled the whole team together. And he said that I was really proud of them because I thought the most important game was the Canada game in the semifinal. Because you lose that one, it's really hard to win a medal. So I said to them, that's the one. And he said, the way we played the first 40 minutes in that game, like, I couldn't have been more proud. So he said to them, look, I know you guys are disappointed, but this should be one of the greatest moments of your life.
Yeah.
And you have to accept it as such and embrace it as such. You can't be down because you lost the game. He said they had no idea how much the country was captivated until they got home.
Really?
Yeah, he said, like, people were coming up to them on the street. I said, has anyone paid for a meal for you? He laughed. He goes, I'm working on that. He said, you got a note from the television station the other day that the final was watched by more than 500 million people. He said that only happens for soccer, like, not for us. And, you know, the most interesting thing that he said was I asked him about all of the notes and messages he received, and he said that he really felt that one of the real disappointments of his career was when he could never make it back after the icing injury. He said that because he worked so hard to get back, and he really felt that all that hard work was never rewarded because he could never play again. And there's a guy that you know who used to be the media relations guy in Boston, but he's now a VP there. He's a real big shot. His name is Matt Shimura.
Yeah, yeah.
And he said that Matt Shimura sent him a note, and it was along the lines of, like, no, you felt that all that work never paid off. Well, this, it shows you that everything pays off in the end. And I like that. I thought that was a great message. And, you know, he did say he's got a world championship to prepare for, and he's got a contract in the German league. But he is looking to come back to North America, and he wants to coach in the NHL someday, whether it's to start as an assistant or wherever. Mm-hmm. He understands, but, you know, he's a guy who wants to come back to North America and coach.
Happening more and more now. It was, and for the longest time in the NHL, it just never happened. At what point do we start to see more Europeans behind the bench in significant capacity in the NHL?
Well, I think that's going to help, right? Like, we had Alpo Suonen, and that didn't work. The thing is, like, Alpo Suonen didn't work because he wanted to bring in a Finnish system, and he even admitted it's going to take until February until they figure it out. Like, you can't do that anymore.
Yeah, dump the puck in, face up against the glass, and get it to the front of the net.
I think Sturm is, like, a North American-European hybrid. Like, to me now, it's like, what's the most important thing about coaching? Can you get players to play for you? Like, Marco Sturm, it's obvious that those players bought into what he was selling. That's why he's an attractive candidate to me. Mm-hmm. He took a team and he said, guys, this is what we got to do, and they bought in. And, you know, it's funny. Like, he said to me that two of his favorite coaches were Daryl Sutter and Claude Julien because those guys were fair, but they were honest. They didn't lie. And they worked hard. Those guys worked hard. And he said, like, that's what he learned as a coach. You have to be honest. You have to be fair. And you have to work. Like, you have to show that you're willing to work. And, like, to me, if I'm coaching an NHL team, I'm looking at him because it's very obvious that that team bought what he was selling.
Here's my feeling on coaching right now in the NHL. Why would you do it? I look at every single coach around the NHL, and all I see is stress. And it starts in training camp. And you get a couple of weeks off, maybe to decompress in the summer, and then you're right back at it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, these guys are playing playoff hockey from the hop in October.
Yep.
Just look at Doug Weight, for example. He might be the best one right now. Doug Weight, you know, was, you know, always a wonderful interview, a great quote, you know, great sense of humor, always a wonderful interview.
He's dying this year.
Looks like he's...
I saw him in...
Did you see him interview with Shannon Hogan the other week?
Another emotional one for your team, but just your take on Christopher Gibson even getting an applause here in the arena for the work that he put in this game.
Yeah, two good goalies going at it. They played well.
When you're going to look at the decision for who's going in the shootout, what goes into that?
I don't know. Just... You got to make decisions. You got to put people out that you think might score a goal.
Yeah, I saw him in Vancouver when I was out there to do the Barzal interview. He's tough. I'll tell you this.
It grates on you so. I feel bad for him.
You know who was the guy that stood out for me at the GM meetings? Peter Chiarelli.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I reach a point where I don't...
Piling on?
Yeah, it's like, you know what?
Well, people are bringing up the Wheeler trade now.
Yeah, no. Beverly. It's like, look, you can't escape... Teams having a bad year, GM's having a rough year, you got to talk about it, right? But I reach a point where it's like, okay, we know this already. You don't need to kick a guy when he's down. And I saw an Alain Vigneault at times this year I've never seen before. Like, even when he was in Montreal or Vancouver and it wasn't going well, mm-hmm. he was always cool and calm, I thought, or portrayed it. In New York this year, he looked stressed out early in the season.
But doesn't everybody look stressed out to you?
But I'm saying, like, and like
everybody does.
Peter Chiarelli this year at the GM meetings, like, I looked at him and I was like, man, that's a year that's taken a toll on a guy.
Well, look at his head coach. Look at Todd McClellan. Yeah, look at the assistant. Look at Jay Woodcroft.
Like, you know, Todd McClellan, he looks like the president. Like, Obama and George Bush, they looked like healthy young guys or youngest guys when they started, and they aged in 8 years. Like, Todd McClellan this year, he has aged.
Over 1 year, over one season.
I know. And I reach a point where I'm like, okay, everybody knows this has gone bad. When do you stop putting the boots to a guy? And I've reached that point with those guys. Like, it's enough. Like, just everybody knows what's going on.
Bergevin, same thing in Montreal?
Yeah, I do think that too. We all know what's going on. it's enough. But unfortunately, and what somebody said to me was, you know, they still have to make decisions that can affect the team. And I'm like, I get that. I think you have to make a choice on whether those guys can still make the decisions. Mm-hmm. But I'm like, okay, I understand all that. There's really not a lot they can do right now. Time out.
Okay.
At least for me. Not everyone's like that. I feel that way.
I get sick of the piling on. I don't need it. A couple things before we get to a couple of Ask 31s. I thought of something goofy a while ago. I've been wanting to bring it up on the podcast. We had a conversation with John Shannon just like close to a month ago. And I've always pushed this question. So for any officials listening right now, what would the answer be? I haven't called any officials to ask them what the answer would be because I just wanted to throw it out here on the podcast. Mm-hmm. I'm going to give you a scenario. Okay. First of all, let me preface it by saying stick length is regulated in the NHL.
Yes.
There's a maximum length that your stick can be. Now, bigger players have provisions that they're allowed to exceed, I think, by 2 inches, allowed to put an extension on it. So this is Tyler Myers, Zdeno Chara. I think Provorov may have gotten an extension on his stick as well. He did when he was with Brandon. I think he's same in Philadelphia. But for some of the bigger players, they're allowed to have an extension on their stick.
Yeah.
But only for a certain few. Here's my scenario. Boston Bruins are playing. Brad Marchand breaks his stick. He goes by the bench. Chara sticks his out. Marchand grabs it.
Yep.
Marchand scores a goal with Zdeno Chara's stick.
Mm-hmm.
Does it count?
Oh, my God. You are the only guy in the world who thinks of this stuff. Like, seriously, Emil, who does this.
Does it count?
Do you know anybody else who thinks of this stuff?
This is, come on, man. What do you think? Does it count or not? I haven't asked any officials about this.
I'm going to say he's using an illegal stick.
I would think so, too. But we'll see.
I have to say this. I would like everyone to know that I have not spent a second thinking about this before Jeff just brought it up. And that is the reason that I have to be sharp to do this, because I know that Jeff is going to come at me with one scenario that no sane human being would think
of. No sane human being.
And like,
there's so many things that shock me. Like when I found out Ryan O'Reilly had two tongues on his skates last week when I was in Buffalo.
See, that's the thing. Like,
that's great.
I know. There you go. Like, you look for things at a level that a lot of other people wouldn't think of.
But don't you think it's going to happen one day? All of a sudden, like Nick Ehlers grabs Tyler Myers' stick and scores. Hold on a second here.
That would really be something. I hope it happens.
So do I.
I hope it happens in the game I'm doing. I'm going to say, hey, you know who called this one? Merrick called this one.
Yeah.
I got to think that's no goal.
I would think so too, but I don't know. I don't know. And I
But you know what I would do if I was one of those guys and I did it? I would take the stick and I'd throw it away.
Break it right away.
Yeah.
Like Jason Spezza when he's going to get, I remember Spezza would break his blade when he's getting called on a stick violation because his blade was illegal.
Or Vladimir Guerrero's brother, Wilton, who broke his bat and then tried to collect it because the rubber balls were all inside it.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic. Okay, a couple of Ask 31s to conclude the podcast today. From Maros Borak, would you be in favor of teams being required to buy out no trade, no move clause instead of asking players to waive it? Yeah.
You can buy out a no move, no trade clause.
I think he's implying in order for that team to move that player,
mm-hmm.
you can offer him $500,000 to waive the no move.
Oh, I don't think the league would ever allow that.
No, it doesn't. It's not in the CBA.
No.
This would be.
Oh, hey, I'm for anything that increases player movement. I don't think the league would ever go for that.
Sean Ferris, Blue Jackets seem to be under the radar for a playoff run. Strong 5-on-5 play, but poor special teams. That's the truth. Who is your under the radar team? From Sean Ferris.
Oh, boy.
I've said it for so many years, I'm almost embarrassed to say it.
Who's that?
Sharks. They're playing great.
I got to tell you.
I'm going back. She loves me, right? She still loves me. I'm going to go back there.
The only bad thing about Gerard Gallant and the year he's had is it's wiped out so many other coaches who've had great years.
Pete DeBoer is doing great.
Peter DeBoer is having a great year. Dave Haxtell, who the Philly fans wanted to fire, is having a hell of a year. John Hines is having a hell of a year.
Bruce Cassidy.
Bruce Cassidy's having a great year. You know, Jared Bednar. What a year that guy has had.
Yep.
But, yes, Peter DeBoer's had a great year. And I'll tell you something else. You know who gets no attention? Maybe the best player in the league to get no attention is Mark Edwards Vlasic.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he's probably been their best player this year.
Mm-hmm.
And
will he be on your Norris ballot?
He's going
to
be around.
Which you now have
there.
To reveal?
Yes, I'm good with that. I don't think he's going to win it. I think he's in the conversation.
Okay. This from Ted at that guy 11920. What do you think the chances are that Morgan Frost makes the Flyers out of camp? 1 to 5 scale. He's probably a year and a half away.
The reason I would say a 2 is I'm a big believer in the surest predictor of future behavior is past behavior. And Ron Hextall is a marinade guy.
He's a marinade guy, and they have Nolan Patrick there to satisfy that second-line center spot, and he's going to keep him there and hold it, and that's going to allow Morgan Frost to play another year of junior and then play in the American League following that. And then after about 4 or 5 months, I think we'll see. I think we'll see where Morgan Frost is at.
Yeah, but I think he's a marinade guy. He'll opt for the slower route unless he blows his socks off.
From Ernesto, can you assess the job Dale Talon has done in Florida since returning? He's kind of left everything in place.
You know, well, the one thing he gets grief for is the Riley Smith Marchessault thing. There's no question about that. You know, Marchessault going and scoring 30 goals somewhere else. Every GM has their good. Every GM has their bad. But I'll tell you.
Still like, getting raked about Dave Bolin, too. You know, and like Lawson Crouse. Although he didn't trade
him. Every GM has their good and their bad. But he hired Bob Bugner, which looks like a real good call.
Yeah. Paul McFarland, too. That looks nice.
Yeah, he drafted a lot of those guys. The one thing that the computer boys may not get enough credit for is the contracts they assigned to a lot of these guys. Jonathan Huberdeau's contract, it's a good contract.
Even the Ekblad deal? Like, that's a doughty deal.
Yeah, the Ekblad one is a tough one. But like I said, like, they did some good and they did some bad, like everybody else. The biggest mistake those guys made was the way they treated some people. Like the people behind the scenes. They fired the equipment guys. They fired the trainers.
They fired like 30 people.
They fired the person who ran the rink, the practice rink.
Yeah.
Like when that happens, the knives come out for you. You can make all the good or bad decisions you want, but how you treat people will always give you the extra rope or take away the extra rope. But, you know, the Ekblad contract, yes, that was a lot. But, you know, the Huberto contract looks like a great contract.
Yep.
The Barkov contract looks like a great contract. The Mark Pesek trade looks like that is going to turn out to be a better deal than
that was
they,
computer boys. That was Kulikov.
Yeah, they thought. Yep. Dale made a mistake this year on Marchessault. But I'll tell you, he made a great call on Bugner.
And there you go, Florida Panthers. And it might come down to the final game of the season, man, for the Panthers. I hope so.
Mitch Kirzner, who's our executive producer of the studio here, is like, I mean, we get a lot of our playoff work done if that one's decided before. And I'm like, Mitch, I hope that one matters. You have to stay up really late on Sunday.
You know what? I signed up to do the game. I got a note from someone here at Sports saying, hey, if it comes down to that last game, we're going to air it. Do you want to do it? I got back in about 2 seconds. He said, are you kidding? For sure I'll do Florida-Boston.
Mitch likes to go to bed
game.
About 6:30 at night, so I hope that...
So he doesn't have to watch Hockey Central tonight, this little nickel and dime show that I paddle every
so
three nights a week.
I hope this makes him work.
All right, and there you go. And now our work on this podcast is done. Thanks to Jason York for stopping by the broadcast today. I hope you enjoyed it. 31 Thoughts, the podcast, returns in 7. When are we recording next week, guys? Do we know?
We'll be back Wednesday? Wednesdays. Yeah, we'll be back to Wednesday.
Be back to Wednesday. Your schedules have been a little bit goofy, folks, so we apologize. Thanks for bearing with us. So on behalf of Elliot and Emil and our guest, Jason York, thanks so much for tuning in. We're back in 6 days here on the podcast.